24/7 Radio Network, broadcasting from AM and FM stations around the country. Welcome to the Small Business Administration award-winning School for Startups Radio, where we talk all things small business and entrepreneurship. Now, here is your host, the guy that believes anyone can be a successful entrepreneur because entrepreneurship is not about creativity, risk, or passion, Jim Beach.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another exciting edition of School for Startups Radio. I hope you're having a great day because I have a great show for you today. First up, we have Taylor Scott. He has been through all of the great, great brands in hospitality and like Disney and all of the others, and has got a new book out about the spirit of a giver, giving hospitality, that generosity is at the core of what you are doing and thinking and acting. So absolutely great conversation. Totally the way all of us should be handling our clients and our suppliers and our friends and everybody else. And so I'm excited to introduce Taylor to you. Then we're welcoming back to the show Margot Biznow. She is the expert on how to raise an entrepreneurially wise child. And both of her children turned out amazing as entrepreneurs. And this is a great conversation. I really appreciate Margot. She's been so nice to me. She's one of the proofreaders for our book. I mean, reviewers, and she'll proof whenever she finds a mistake, she lets me know. And so she's been absolutely invaluable to me. Thank you so much, Margot. And I had another thing I wanted to point out. I kind of messed up. You know, I always let you know if we have a billionaire coming up 3 or 4 days in advance. I'll say billionaire alert. Well, I missed a billionaire alert. We had a billionaire on the show recently, and you should be able to figure it out. I marked it in the pod or the transcript area, the postings, the listings that he hangs out with King Charles. So you should be able to figure it out. But we have a moron on alert now. So that means in the next few shows, can't be this show because that wouldn't be nice. In the next few shows, we have an absolute moron on. See if you can figure out who it is. We are back, and again, thank you so very much for being with us. You know, having a good vacation is important, but it's even more important that we could take those skills, those leadership skills, the skills of being hospitable, and put them in every part of every business. Please welcome Taylor Scott to the show. He is author of a new book called Lead with Hospitality. It has some 95 five-star reviews on Amazon. Very impressive. Taylor has a long career in the hospitality space. He worked 20 years for places like Disney, Gaylord Wynn Resorts, the Cosmopolitan at Las Vegas, and has taken all of that knowledge and put it into his book. Taylor, welcome to the show. How are you doing today?
Great. How are you? Thanks so much for having me.
What is the favorite place you've worked? What was the dreamiest place that you've worked at?
I've had a few. I mean, Disney World, Walt Disney World for me. I mean, I grew up in Kentucky, so you know, not unlike others that grow up on that side of the world, that's out of our country, going to Walt Disney World for vacation. So being able to work there at the start of my career was definitely a dream come true. Later in life, you know, I live in Las Vegas right now. So I've had the opportunity to work in a couple places in Las Vegas. I'm going to say a three-way tie: Walt Disney World in general, Wynn Las Vegas here in Vegas, and then the Cosmopolitan of Las Vegas. I had a chance to be on the opening team there about 15 years ago. And so I loved what we were trying to pull off there as well.
Is Vegas really suffering the way that the media is making it out right now?
Well, it depends on who you talk to, and it probably depends on the day of the week and what area of town that you go. But I would say, overarchingly, in general terms, all of that is true. Like the reality is international travel is significantly down. The reality is a lot of anybody that knows anything about this market will tell you that Southern California is the lifeblood, because in between the conventions and shows and special events, this town relies on Southern California, Northern Arizona, for that, you know, weekend warrior traffic. And that is significantly down. So the answer is it's all true.
All right. That's, I think a lot of America is saying you deserve it, Vegas. You know, the breathing our air fee that they have now. I thought that was one too far. You know, you can have a fee for the gym and a fee for the internet, but now you're going to charge me for air. I'm being facetious, of course, but that's the way it just feels there, you know? So
it is true. Things have, you know, prices have gone up in all of our lives, in everything that we experience day to day, and hospitality destinations are no exception. And so I would agree with you, like things like you used to be able to just, for example, as a local, you could go park at all the places, you know, on the strip for free. Now most places you got to pay. And then the whole resort fee thing, you know, when I first got out here to this market in 2008, you know, that was a point of contention. Not everybody did it. Now everybody does it. So it really is a situation where prices have gone up for everything from food to drinks to room rates, parking, resort fees. So that's another opportunity for this market to figure out.
Why is the Wynn better than most other hotels across the world? What makes a great hotel great?
Yeah, I'll tell you something, that a former mentor of mine, when I worked at Disney, I led the sales team at Disney Vacation Club, Disney's version of timeshare, for a few years based at the Disneyland Resort. And I had a really high up senior executive, who was a part of bringing me on. And then, you know, we stayed in close contact the whole time I was there. And he told me something, and this is what will answer your question. He told me, Taylor, the reason why the Disney brand is so great, and the reason why we believe at Disney Vacation Club, we are different and offer up a more meaningful experience than other vacation ownership brands. He said, it's not any one thing. There are no silver bullets, he said. He said, it's just doing a lot of little things consistently over time. And that's what I would say to Wynn does, Wynn Las Vegas. So the attention to detail, the commitment to quality of everything from the type of fabric to the type of human being that they hire, to the type of training, to the type of material they use at the front desk, the ropes, the curtains, the technology, the equipment, the aesthetics, everything is on purpose with a purpose for a purpose, and they don't compromise. I had an executive at the Wynn tell me early on in my tenure there, he was talking to me about, we were getting ready to open Encore. So that gives you an idea when I was there. And it was tough because we had to like do the whole thing where you fly the plane and build the plane at the same time. Yep. So we had to run and operate Wynn Las Vegas. And then everybody was focused on also the pre-opening of and getting ready to open Encore. And we were getting ready to do a grand hire event. And as the COO pulled me aside, it was right as they were placing me as the director of Red Card, which is essentially the director of loyalty marketing. And Red Card is their version of the Players Club. You know, you get your card, you go put it in slot machines and present it at table games and you get your points and all that. And he told me a sort of a little pep talk as we were getting ready to go to our grand hire, you know, season where we're hiring all of our opening team members for Encore. He reminded me of the things that they believe in. And he told me this line I've never forgotten. He said, and we don't compromise. And so that's always stuck with me. So that's one thing I believe they have continued to stick to, all these years later, when I go back there as a guest, they still do not compromise. It is about quality and excellence in everything they do.
All right. Tell us about the book. It looks like it walks through every single part of the experience. Interesting titles: encouragement, grace, importance, characteristics I would love to see with anyone giving me hospitality. Walk us through the book a little bit.
Yeah, what I wanted to do with this project, and it came out in April of 2021, so it's been out in the market for about 4 years now. We just put out a brand new book called Give Hospitality, which is a leadership fable. Talks about, it's a story. So a lot of the same or similar type of content and tenets. But for Lead with Hospitality, the reason I wanted to do this, it started out as a passion project. Because I was curious, why do we love and follow certain leaders more so than we do others? And so what I found was, is we love our favorite leaders for the same reasons we love our favorite hospitality destinations like Disney or the Wynn or the Cosmopolitan. And 9 times out of 10, it's because of how they make us feel. So what I wanted to do was draw some parallels between leadership and hospitality. And that's what the book Lead with Hospitality is all about. There's 4 parts to the book: connect, serve, engage, inspire, in that order. And the reason why I did it in that order, it's very purposeful and symbolic. And everybody that's listening right now, that those of you know that you've been a leader for a while, or maybe you just got into a leadership position, perhaps some of you have made the same mistake that I've made and many of us make when we first get that leadership job or we get a new job and we're so excited that we get in there and start trying to coach and inspire right away before we've successfully connected and served. So that's what the book walks through, those 4 parts. So it's everything from having a commitment to connection first, connecting with those people on your team on a human level. And then slowly but surely, you're getting to the point where you're serving them, you're listening, you're educating, you're taking action, you're delivering on your promise as their leader. And then you can slowly but surely earn the right to advance. You can earn the right and build that credibility to be able to coach them and give them feedback. And then when that starts happening, you've now created an environment that's inspiring. You've created an environment where people are inspired to do more, become more, and actually give their absolute best. And that's what I believe leadership is all about. If people would just show up and be awesome and do their best organically, naturally, without any help from any of us at all, then we wouldn't need leaders. We wouldn't need coaches. We wouldn't need executives. So that's what the book's all about.
And then move on to the new book. I wasn't aware of that one, or I missed it somehow. Give Hospitality, the Fable. Tell us about that. Why do fables work so well for teaching business principles?
Well, I believe that based on what I learned when I did the Lead with Hospitality project and from my time working in sales for places like, you know, Walt Disney Parks and Resorts down in Orlando, and then later in life, Disney Vacation Club out in Disneyland, is there's some science behind this where emotions and feelings actually drive our decisions. They drive our decisions to act and react and how we're going to respond. So, over the years, you know, I had the opportunity, John Gordon, the guy that wrote the book, The Energy Bus, it's been on the Wall Street Journal bestseller list for like 12 years now. You know, that's a fable. And he's written 22, 23 other fables. Well, I was fortunate enough that he wrote the foreword to Lead with Hospitality. So I'm a guy that's just been studying those types of people for years, from being a practitioner, being a front desk manager and a housekeeping manager and a bell services manager. And then later in life, a department head and then an executive, you know, actually, you know, leading people and teams. I was always inspired by the stories. And so what I wanted to do is just see if I could, you know, practice what I preach and see if we could appeal to another audience or incremental audiences that perhaps would be more inspired by a story than a how-to book. So what Give Hospitality is the subtitle. It's a hopeful story of what happens when we live, work, and love from a place of generosity. So it's about a young up and coming leader in the hospitality industry. And she leaves the toxic job of the toxic boss. And she goes to work in a more magical place that I've made up in my mind and in my heart, loosely inspired by some of the greatest places that I have worked, whether it be Walt Disney World, Disneyland, Gaylord Hotels, Wynn, Encore, Cosmopolitan, whatever the case may be. But I created a place in my heart and my mind called Kauela Resorts. Kauela means summertime in Hawaiian. So the young up-and-comer's name is Summer Grace. And the story is about her first 2 weeks on the job when she goes through the Kauela Resorts orientation experience. And there's when she learns how they have been able to create such a positive, productive, and inclusive workplace culture. And it's based on their 5 core values, which are the following: give compassion, give encouragement, give kindness, give hospitality, and give leadership. And here's the other purposeful thing I did or tried to do with the story is those five values follow what it means that what I've learned, what the aloha spirit means. So Kauela Resorts is Hawaiian theme that's rooted in the aloha spirit. And so this story, this book, this project, what I'm doing is a portion of the proceeds that come from the book or keynotes or any of the leadership development work that we do that's tied to the Give Hospitality Project, we're donating a portion of those proceeds to the Hawaii Community Foundation's Maui Strong Fund to help with the rebuilding and recovery efforts after the wildfires 2 years ago that decimated Lahaina Harbor down there on Maui.
Excellent. That is a great cause. I used to live in Hawaii, and so visited there many times, and sure was sad to see what happened and learn of all the circumstances of incompetent government that led to that, making it so much worse. But anyway, is it possible for the CEO to break a company all the way so badly that customers stay away?
Well, there is something to be said for it all starts from the top and things do run downhill. So that could go one of two ways for leaders, whether you're CEO or you're a leader of any team on any level. What you do, and more so how you do it, will either, you know, allow more negativity to foster, or it will begin to curb that negativity. So the choice is really up to any given leader that's in one of those roles. So that from that, I say, absolutely. All we have to do is look at history, and you can see the things that happen at the top. Just ask the people at Enron or, you know, Farmore or any of these companies that we've seen the shadiness going on. And even here in my market here in Las Vegas, you know, you take a look at the news, and I'm not going to name names of any brands, but there's been some shadiness happening at the top of some of these places. And unfortunately, a lot of people have been compromised. Their day, whether it was their data that was compromised, their finances were compromised, and then people have actually lost their jobs. They've lost their careers because of, to your point, some incompetence and just some really malintent by people that are in leadership positions that aren't exhibiting what I believe to be strong moral character and what we would think of as a true leader.
What about Disney running away from their customer base? Do you still think that they're a family-centered company?
Yeah, in what ways are you referencing that they've run away from their customer base?
I'm part of their customers, and they've run away from me. Their movies have sucked recently. They've gotten preachy. You know, they're telling me what to think as opposed to just entertaining the family. Yeah, I mean, you can go anywhere anywhere and find lots of people upset with Disney these days. And Eisner's a big part of it. Not Eisner, Iger. And what's Kathleen Kennedy, I think. You know, there's whole TV shows about Kathleen Kennedy being so difficult.
Yeah, Disney's a storytelling company. I remember when Bob Iger first came in as CEO. I mean, he was already within the company. He was at ABC. You know, Eisner steps aside. Iger takes the CEO role back in 2005. I was an up and comer then. That was 20 years ago. I was an up and comer, a sales manager based in Orlando, working in sales at Walt Disney Parks and Resorts. And you know, I was there, a cast member. I got the email from him. You know, the whole company got an email from him saying he's excited to start his new role in the show. And he laid out sort of his grand plan, and it was, we're going to focus on intellectual property. We're going to focus on, you know, capitalizing on that and some synergies that we can build from that. We're going to focus on the technological advances and the future lies in our ability to leverage technology. And the third pillar was storytelling. He reminded everybody that Disney always has been and always will be a storytelling company. And so here we are all these years later. You know, he retired and he had to come back. He had to come back. And since he's gotten back, there's been some significant improvements in many different facets of the Walt Disney Company's business. And so what you're describing is opinion. And so you certainly have yours and you're entitled to that. Other people are entitled to theirs. I would just say that they continue to be focused on storytelling, whether it's through their movies, through their attractions, consumer products, certainly theme parks. I don't necessarily agree with all of the things that they've done business-wise, whether it be how they, you know, the, particularly in the theme parks with the fast passes and lightning lane, and you kind of have to study up and you got to be prepared now. And you got, it's a, the experience has changed because you're having to look at your phone most of the time and plan out your day. Whereas it used to be a little bit more, you know, organic, and you can sort of, it was fluid. You could kind of like, you know, change your mind if you got in the middle of Epcot and you decided you wanted to go to the studios, and but now you have to be a little bit more structured. There's pros and cons to that. So that's about as comfortable as I'm going to get in terms of, you know, speaking about, you know, your opinion versus other people's opinions of how they have or have not run away from their customers.
Well, look at the pricing though, too. There's an article a day on how it's so expensive, and the volume, the numbers are down right now. The parks are quote unquote empty. You know, July 4th was the worst July 4th ever I saw. Not ever, but you know, like since the 90s or something. So I think Disney, is just the numbers, the attendance numbers, and that's also got back to Vegas. That's back to the, Walt Disney's prices have gone crazy too. So have salaries stayed level, or have you had an increase in your salary as all of the other costs have gone up, Taylor, and the you know, overall inflation in every other sector? Has hospitality salaries done okay?
Yeah, I mean, I've been an entrepreneur now since 2020. I started a business basically out of necessity during the pandemic because I got laid off. I did a career switch from having, you know, what I would say traditional leadership jobs in hospitality and entertainment that we've spoken about here. And then I wanted to get into being an author and a speaker and a thought leader. And I like leadership development. So I like being able to be with rooms of people and groups of people and pour into them and help them become better at being leaders. So I had done a career transition to work for a consulting firm. And, you know, during the pandemic, I lost my job. So that's where Lead with Hospitality was born. I sat here in my kitchen and I sort of took a passion project and turned it into a Word document and sent a Hail Mary and ended up getting a book deal and then created a bunch of leadership development content that goes with it and have created a business with keynote speaking, leadership development, and then now content licensing as well, where organizations are licensing my content to use with their teams. So, I'm on a different side of the fence now. So from my perspective, it depends on the line of business. It depends on what kind of job it is. I have seen some salaries go up. Others, to your point, have not really increased, I believe, as much as the cost of living, for example, has. And it's really challenging because it depends on where you are in the country. And it depends on sometimes where you are within any given market. So you could be in New York State versus New York City, and the cost of living is drastically different. Same goes for Las Vegas. You can be in a certain part of town and get by on salary of X, and another part of town, your money's going to go a little bit further, and you're going to get a little bit more house, you know, for what you're paying. So the classic, you know, cop out answer, you know, any economics question I learned in an undergrad, an economics professor to say, any answer to an economics question could be, it depends. So it depends on the job, it depends on what level, and it depends on what line of business.
And then he only has one arm, because I'm tired of the two opinioned economists. So I was an econ major as well. Yeah. When you go out, do you have trouble not just watching the good or the bad of the employees, the staff around you?
Yeah, it's sort of a curse, man. It's a blessing and a curse. So it is a challenge. I really can't, whether I'm on an airplane or going to a restaurant, a bar, in an Uber, staying in a hotel. Sure, I'm always breaking it down. I break down the service. I break down the operation. I break down the quality, the product, the process. So yeah, it's a blessing and a curse. I love to learn. So that's the cool part of it, is you're learning about different brands and different experiences as you go. But also it's really easy to get frustrated because you know what it could be. And you know how simple some of this stuff can be to make some changes, to appeal to your point, to appeal to people in a little bit more positive way, whether it be financial, emotional, or what have you. So yeah, it's a challenge.
Is hospitality born in you, or can you truly teach it?
I think anybody can be taught. I really do, because it comes down to how well those that are teaching or how well those that are trying to influence are connecting with you on a human level and are emotionally, dare I say, emotionally connecting with you. Because back to our earlier conversation, you know, we are all of us humans, we are all wired to feel before we think. So whether you're leading someone, selling to someone, trying to influence someone, it behooves all of us to connect with them on a human level and find out what matters to them. And it's our job. So if I'm somebody that's trying to teach people how to do hospitality or teach people how to lead with hospitality, then one of the first things I got to do is I got to be committed to a connection with them. And I got to find out what drives them. I got to find out how to make this about them. And that means finding out what they value. It means finding out what they want to do when they grow up, what they want to do next. And more importantly, how can I help them? And like, once you do that, you show up differently than perhaps a lot of other people have ever showed up in their lives. So now you have a little bit more credibility. You have a little bit more respect. And when you have credibility and respect, you start to build trust. And so that's why I believe that anybody can learn it, but it really depends on from whom you're learning.
Very well said. Very well said. Taylor, we're about out of time, I'm afraid. How do we find out more? Follow online, get a copy of the books, get the training material, all of that, please.
Yeah, leadwithhospitality.com. You'll find information on us, our business, me, my bio. You'll also find other things like how to work with us, whether it be keynote speaking, leadership development workshops, frontline guest service experience workshops. And then my content licensing is on there as well. I have 3 books, Ball Games to Boardrooms, Lead with Hospitality, and Give Hospitality, all available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and wherever books are sold.
Fantastic. Fantastic. And so where do you want to go on vacation? Where's your dream vacation?
For me, it's hard to beat Maui. My in-laws are down there right now sending us pictures every 5 minutes. Mama's Fish House, Sail Trilogy catamarans. And I'm looking at my wife like, okay, it's time to go back. It's time to go back. And we were just there in June. So it's time to go back already.
Oh, it's been such a long time. How do you feel?
I know. It's rough.
Thanks for being with us, and we will be right back.
Well, that's a wonderful question, actually, Jim.
Oh my gosh, I love the opportunity to do this. Thank you, Jim.
Wow, that's a great one.
You know, that is a phenomenal question.
That's a great question, and I don't have a great answer.
That's a great question.
Oh, that is such a loaded question, and that's actually a really good question.
School for Startups Radio.
We are back, and again, thank you so very much for being with us. I'm very excited to welcome back to the show Margot Biznow. She is an author, a longtime 20-year government employee, worked her way up to the chief of staff for the President's Council of Economic Advisors. You don't get much more prestigious than that. She has had her own popular daily online social newsletter, and she has released a book that I love the title and the premise of, and so that's why we invited her back. The book is called Raising an Entrepreneur: How to Help Your Children Achieve Their Dreams, 99 Stories from Families Who Did. That's the second book, I think. There was the first book, right? Help me here, Margo.
That's the second edition.
Okay, yeah. Right, with the 99
and
stories.
And the good one. That's the good one.
Yes. Okay. Welcome back. How are you doing?
Thanks, Jim. I'm so happy to be back.
Tell me one of the stories from the book, the 99 stories. I'd love to hear one of those.
Well, I would love to tell you the story of John Chu, who is written about these days because he is the director of Wicked, and the second half of Wicked is coming out, I think, in a month. Both his parents were immigrants. They run a restaurant in Palo Alto called Chef Chu's. He grew up with not a ton of money, 5 siblings, no connections, and he's become the hottest director in Hollywood. And he's also an incredibly nice person. And when he was, he fell in love with directing film, making little films when he was in fourth grade. And he was always trying to do it. And when he was in high school, he was supposed to be asleep. And his mom came into his room and he was working on a video. And his mom said, go to sleep and stop wasting your time with this nonsense. You need to be prepared for school so you do well tomorrow. And he said, you can't make me stop. This is what I want to do for my life. I love this. And he burst into tears. And his mom said, go to sleep. We'll talk about it tomorrow. And the next day she picked him up at school and she'd been to the library and she had 10 filmmaking books. And she said, if you want to do it, be the best.
Wow. That is a very cool story. Heartwarming.
Very cool story. Heartwarming. And I've met his parents. They're the nicest people. And obviously, they're very proud.
So when did you get an interest in entrepreneurial parenting? How did this evolve as part of your consciousness?
In 2008, our older son, Elliot, started an organization called Summit or Summit Series that was conferences of young entrepreneurs. And I can tell you about how he started it if you want.
Yeah,
but in
sure,
any event,
you brought it up, you got to tell us.
Okay, so he just thought it would be really cool to be an entrepreneur, and he wanted to meet them, and he didn't think he was cool enough that they would talk to him on his own. And so he cold called and invited 18 young entrepreneurs for an all-expense-paid ski weekend in Utah. And it was going to be a one-off. This was 2008. They were all under 30, and none of them had ever met anyone like themselves before. And they just couldn't stop talking. And at the end, they all said, you have to do this again, and I want to bring five friends. And it was really cool people. It was people like Sam Altman from ChatGPT and Blake Makowski from Tom's Shoes. And, but none of them, nobody had heard of any of them. I mean, they were young guys. Blake had sold, I think, 10,000 shoes. And, so he, you know, got a couple people that he'd met to help him and he did another one. But my favorite part of this story is that, before the event, he had, called North Face. He was trying to get sponsors and they said, well, we won't send you money, but we'll send everybody duffel bags and jackets. And afterwards he was skiing with a reporter and the reporter asked, what do you call this organization? And he hadn't thought it would be an organization. And he went, and he looked down at his sleeve of his jacket and he said, Summit Series, because North Face Summit Series. So that's how it got its name. And starting about 2010, I started going to all his events, and I didn't know young entrepreneurs, and I was so curious how they had turned out. And I'd ask them, like, how did you end up working so hard to turn your idea into... I had someone who believed in me, who told me I could do anything I put my mind to. Usually it was a family member. Even more usually it was their mom. And I was so struck by this, I just kept talking about it. My kid said, you have to write a book. And I said, I can't write a book. And they're like, you have to write a book. And I said, I can't write a book. And they said, you have to write a book. I said, okay, I'll write a book. So that's how it happened.
Very interesting. Why do you think so many, well, I want to come back to that. How did everyone pay for the summit, first of all? You said it was free?
The first one?
Yes. Pay for it?
Yeah, he, some of it he got sponsors. He got U.S. Doctors for Africa, you know, and some other organizations gave him some money. And the rest he put on my credit card, and because he didn't have, I don't think he had one at the time. And he was just like right out of college a year. And he paid it off.
Wow,
he paid it back.
Cool. All right. So what commonalities do you see in the reasons people become entrepreneurs? Did you start to see any commonalities other than they had support of somebody? Because I've talked about this a lot. I have my own theories on this. So what did you see, Margo?
So you can't make your child an entrepreneur any more than you can make your child an orchestra conductor. All of these, of the 70 people that are in the book, only five of the 70 have a sibling who's an entrepreneur. And in all five cases, they have another sibling who's not an entrepreneur. So the point is, it has to be you have to have the right personality. You have to have grit and determination and the ability to grind and things like that. But I think these people, most of them didn't start out saying, I want to become an entrepreneur. Most of them, and I wonder if this is what you find, Jim, most of them got really, really into something. And then they discovered there was something about it that could be done better or could be improved or could be changed. And they thought, I want to do that. And I mean, I can give you sort of example after example.
Some of the,
just one?
Yeah.
gee.
You know, 'cause I don't, go ahead.
Yeah. No, I was going to say Joel Holland, who's one of my favorite people, who was the first person to say yes to Elliot's invitation. He actually did this twice. The first time he was in high school, he talked to the guidance counselor and wanted to have information about careers. And he thought the information was awful. And he contacted some company and said, if I can get interviews with the CEOs of all these big companies, would you pay me to interview them and put it out for kids to find out about different careers? And the company said, yes, he thinks because they didn't think he'd get these interviews.
Right, yeah.
And he did get the interviews, and he was flying around interviewing people. And one of the people he interviewed was Governor Schwarzenegger, who in California. And he came back and he thought, you know, that should have been the most visually interesting conversation, but it was so boring just being in a room. Why can't I have like the, you know, background pictures of the Hollywood sign or something? And then he discovered that you just couldn't do that. And he started a company called Footage Firm and kept that up in high school and all through college. And several years after college, he graduated from Babson, he got, you know, $100,000 job offers. He turned them down. He thought, if I can get them now, I can get them again. He moved back home with his parents. His friends told him he was nuts. Like 5 years later, he sold half of the business for $10 million.
Wow.
He got an RV. He started driving around the country, and he thought, you know, there's so many beautiful places I would love to stay, wineries and farms, and instead I'm staying in these horrible RV parks. I wonder if there's a better way to do that. And he found somebody who had started this little teeny company that you can, it's like $80 a year. It's called Harvest Hosts, and it gives thousands of, now, because he's expanded it by like 100 billion times, it gives you all these great places to stay all over the country, and it's free, but they encourage you, you know, if it's a farm, to buy some farm goods, and if it's a winery, to buy some wine. And so he's done this twice. He saw a gap, and he started a company to fill the gap.
Very impressive. That's so
is cool. That what you find, Jim? Is that with your people?
You know, I was thinking more woo-woo, perhaps, than that. I find that a lot of entrepreneurs have a chip on their shoulder and are trying to prove something. I think Sam Altman is one of those.
Oh, wow. I don't know. I don't find them very chippy people, but I don't know.
I've interviewed 20 people who said, oh, yeah, that's me. A lot of people do. I have a chip on my shoulder. So,
oh dear. Okay.
From getting fired from Coca-Cola. So.
Okay. Yeah. But yeah. I mean, maybe they never. But maybe that gave them the drive. Maybe they didn't have the drive before. But I guess whatever gives you the drive.
Maybe so. Maybe that is it. Anyway, I know that a lot of chips on the shoulder are still active in people's lives. So, Margo, you said you can't teach a child or raise a child to be an entrepreneur. Then why even write the book? What are your thoughts on how we can influence our children?
Oh, you can definitely influence them. And you can give them all of the traits and qualities that if they become an entrepreneur will help them. But if they don't, look, you know this. If you want to be an entrepreneur, you have to work around the clock and you have to take on a lot of risk. And a lot of people don't want to do that. But if you have the right qualities, whether you become a librarian, a teacher, a doctor, a lawyer, whatever, if you will do that better. If I could, if you'd indulge me, it's my favorite list of things from my book. I say, even if your child doesn't want to be an entrepreneur, encouraging them to become more entrepreneurial by promoting certain attitudes can only be a good thing. All children thrive if they learn to believe in themselves, to pursue their true passions, to find new ways to solve old problems, to see opportunity where others see the status quo, to be willing to take on a challenge without proper credentials, to work with single-minded determination to achieve a goal, to take on risk if a project is worth trying, to learn that building something wonderful is its own reward, regardless of how much money you make, to view failure as feedback and setbacks as learning experiences, and to dream big dreams. So if you teach those traits to your children, maybe they'll become an entrepreneur and maybe they'll just be more entrepreneurial and in whatever they do with their life.
Does it help to have a parent that's an entrepreneur and to have one of those families that talks about dinner or talks about business at dinner?
It may, but of the 70, I think there were 3 who had parents who were entrepreneurial.
Ooh, that's interesting. That's an incredibly low data.
Yeah, so I wanted a very diverse group. That's what was important to me. You know, not everyone's going to have a billion-dollar company, and I don't think that's what it means to be entrepreneurial. I just think it means starting something you believe in and doing it on your, you know, just starting something. And it can be in a big company. It can be, I mean, my younger son is a musician. He started a band. I mean, to me, he's an entrepreneur. So I don't think, you know, you have to, it's not like, oh, you've come from a wealthy family and or an entrepreneurial family and they're pushing this all the time. I mean, I think, you know, it just depends if they're pushing, hard work, if they're pushing, grit and determination, and if they're not blaming you when you fail, when you're struggling, there's all sorts of things they can do if they're not entrepreneurs themselves.
Yes. I'm still blown away that only 3 of your group had parental entrepreneurs. I just think that's shocking. So what do you think that you did as a mother to have such independent and creative kids?
I'm sorry, say it again.
As a mother, do you have memories of influencing it?
Yeah. So, I never thought about entrepreneurship and we never talked about entrepreneurship. I was involved in, government, as you said, international economics and international development. My husband was a lawyer and had worked in startups, and we never really thought about working for ourselves, and we never talked about it, really. But the one thing that every one of the entrepreneurs had in common is that they all had a passion outside of school, and their parents supported that passion. And both of our kids had a passion outside of school. My older son, Elliot, the one that started Summit, it was tennis, which he discovered at about age 12. And at that point, it was 5 hours a day, 7 days a week. 51 and a half weeks a year, from all the way through middle school and high school and college. And our younger son, Austin, it was writing music, which he also discovered around 12. And that's a funny story. I'm happy to share that also. But anyhow, sure. he wrote 300 songs before he graduated from high school. And he was just, you know, the music was just flowing out of him. Well, I'd signed him up for a summer of sports camps, and he broke his leg like in the first week. And I was desperately looking around for something to sign him up for, and everything was full. And I found something that included writing music on the computer. And I said, "You're going to this."
And what year was that?
He was 12.
What year was that?
Okay. He graduated, I would say 98, 99, 2000, something like that.
That was one of my programs that he went to, I think.
Really?
Where was it?
In DC?
Yeah, probably so. My first business was a summer camp company, started in 93, and we grew to 89 locations around the country, including several in Washington, teaching anything related to computers, movie making, sound, all of that. And
wow. So, I think this was at Georgetown Visitation School.
Yeah, that was me.
Oh, my God. Jim, this is the most exciting.
As a matter of fact, I might have even been there the weeks that he was there, because Georgetown was one of my schools. You know, there were different people on our team, and I always went to Georgetown because the first time I ever got kissed was in the Georgetown International Studies Building amphitheater outside there. And so I've always liked Georgetown because I got my first kiss there. So
wow, that's the craziest thing I've ever heard. Yeah, well, it changed his life, and you know, the rest is history. But both of our boys,
that way for him,
it was amazing. And both of our boys, you know, they had something they were so passionate about. Neither of them were phenomenal students, but they were working so hard, and they loved it so much, and we were so proud of their success in the things that they loved. I mean, Elliot, who he was really had been good in baseball, and he when he fell in love with tennis again, it was like it was the end. It was like, it was, I think, the summer after fifth grade, and I had 2 weeks at the end of the summer with nothing for him to do, and I found a half day tennis camp, and I said, "You're going to this." And, you know, then he took lessons that year. And by that summer, it was like, "I just want to go to tennis camp." And, it, you know, he didn't start playing tournaments until he was like 13. And at that point, all the other kids who end up being really good are playing regional tournaments, and he lost everything. And he just said, "I know what I'm doing wrong. I'll beat him next time." And he fought his way up to 35 in the country.
Wow.
Yeah. And So does he do anything professionally with tennis? No. But what did he learn? He learned grit and hard work and determination and how to pivot when things weren't going well and how to deal with failure and all the how to deal with not doing well and all these, you know, not looking back. And I mean, all these things you need to be a successful entrepreneur. He learned playing tennis.
Yes, sports are fantastic for kids and their development.
Sports are fantastic, and I don't know, almost half of the people in the book played sports into college. I didn't want to have to say, like, you have to be an athlete to become an entrepreneur, but boy, does it help. I mean, there's other things you can do, obviously, that teach you that same kind of intensity. But I'm a huge fan of kids playing sports.
Me too. I wish I had been better at that. My parents let me get out of it, and so I suffered because of it. Margo, fantastic work that you've done, and thank you so much for sharing your stories and your thoughts and reminiscing about both of your incredible sons. How do we get a copy of the book, especially the new one with the 99 stories?
So it's called Raising an Entrepreneur, How to Help Your Children Achieve Their Dreams, 99 Stories from Families Who Did. It's on Amazon, and you can also get an Audible if you prefer listening. And I would be thrilled if anybody wants to read it. And I'm trying to prepare myself. I'm ready to do your test, your questions.
Okay.
Yes.
Let's play.
I'm going to try.
All right. Number one, your favorite creativity hack.
Just get started.
Number two, favorite bootstrapping trick.
Don't take outside money.
Number three, name your top passions.
Travel to places I've been that I love. Travel to places I haven't been yet. Family dinners and dinners with friends.
Number five, the best way to get your first real customer is?
Just talk to your friends and say, hey, can I ask your advice on something I'm working on?
Your dreamiest technology is?
Well, this is kind of dorky, but I really like ChatGPT.
Number seven, best entrepreneurial advice.
Be sure that what you're working on is a real problem, and be sure you understand it inside and out, and then just get started.
Number eight, worst entrepreneurial mistake.
Agonizing over anything.
Number nine, favorite entrepreneur and why?
I think that's my older son, Elliot, who we were talking about earlier, because, I mean, he's turning 40 next week, which is hard for me to comprehend, and he's now on his third major business, and he never looks back. He's just always optimistic and confident and resilient and forward-looking.
And number 10, favorite superhero?
So I gave this a lot of thought. I don't think I've had a superhero since I was 8, and I liked Zorro. Is that okay?
Sure. Any answer you want. Yes. All right. Remind people how to get in touch with you, where to find you, all of that, please.
Thanks, Jim. My website is raisinganentrepreneur.com, and you can message me from there. I'm on Instagram at Margo Biznow, and I guess I'm on LinkedIn also. So, yeah, I'm pretty reachable.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for being with us, and I'd love to have you back. Thanks a lot. Great stuff.
Thanks, Jim. Talk soon.
And we are out of time, but back tomorrow. Be safe, everyone. Take care, and go make $1 million. Bye now.